Make the right call for the right Medicare Advantage benefits. Go to MedMutual.com/review to schedule your free Medicare plan review with Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? And sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.
Curtain window for October 14th, 2024. I'm Mike Agavino here with the man himself, Woody Overton. Woody.
What's up, buddy? You're alive and you made it through the storm. And, of course, devastation and everything else as is usual. But prayers go out to all those people and still without power and people who lost their lives and all that, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, we were on the periphery of this. The scariest thing we had was really the day of all the tornadoes. We were kind of in between a couple of them, and you could actually see one of them from Interstate 95 while we were on it. But, you know, some trees down in this, we're in an Airbnb for another week or so. And, you know, it lost some trees and that kind of thing, and power for really less than 24 hours. I think we maybe had 18 hours without power. But the stories coming from the other side of the state, the flooding, the devastation. I mean, it's just, and back to back to get slammed like that twice in a 1 week period. I saw a story yesterday in the Post about a married couple named Helene and Milton Aronoff, right? They're both, one died, and the guy died in 2005 and the woman died in 2021, but it's, and there are, you know, all of these stories now around it about, you know, the coincidence that there's no known couple to have those same names, and, you know, what could we possibly connect between that couple and these storms? I mean, crazy stuff. But you know, at least the loss of life was minimized. I mean, something like this happens 50 or 100 years ago, you're looking at a much, much worse situation. So
Well, still from Milton, there's several hundred dead in North Carolina now. Close to 300, and there's still a bunch of people missing. That's what I read this morning.
That's a crazy situation where I just don't know how you plan for that, where you're that many hundreds of miles inland, and the whole nation's watching a storm come ashore and thinking that that's what all the damage from a hurricane is done. You know, there in the mountains of Appalachia, that, you know, you have something like that go on. But hey, we're here to continue our Nittany Lying series about the Penn State scandal. And today we're going to discuss episode 12, which was called The Settlements, from my epic podcast series with John Ziegler and Liz Habib called With the Benefit of Hindsight. And this episode, episode 12, really got a ton of attention when we first dropped it in 2020. And it got a ton of attention because I think for many people, it was the first time, it was the first time names were mentioned as victims in this case. Remember, people were anonymous other than Aaron Fisher through the trial and up until this point. And it was also an indication to many that what we were saying was absolutely possible, that you could have a crime with 36 alleged victims, not 36 people who were paid, 36 people received settlement payments in this case. And you could also have all 36 of their stories not be true. And it's crazy to think about that. And I think for myself back then, as somebody just receiving the news and interpreting what was going on, when you hear 36 victims of anything, the last thing you think is that it might not be true. So this episode opened a lot of eyes that way, because some of the stories of people who got paid are just downright ridiculous. And we're going to get into a couple of those. So as always, Woody, as I'm talking, just stop me, flag me, beat me up. Anything that comes to mind. So the backdrop of this episode, the context is, you know, as Ziegler started, you know, writing and started going after primarily Aaron Fisher and started building a following around his first website and his original short documentary, which was all about the cover-up evidence and that Paterno and the administrators were innocent. He built a following, and he ended up hooking up with several other journalists who had seen the case from a similar point of view as him. And one of them is a guy by the name of Ralph Cipriano, who I follow religiously, his blog, which is called Big Trial. Cipriano is a former LA Times and Philadelphia Inquirer investigative reporter who is now on his own. And you know how I feel about the city of Philadelphia. So Cipriano exclusively these days writes about crime in Philadelphia, and he's a brilliant writer. But Cipriano was given an opportunity by Newsweek to do a cover story on the scandal. And so as he starts digging into his investigation for the cover story, he decides to reach out to Ziegler and say, hey, you followed this case closer than anybody has. I've got this opportunity with Newsweek to write this cover story. Do you want to join forces and jump in with me and combine notes and see where we are? And so Ziegler says, absolutely. And it's Cipriano, not Ziegler, who is able to secure the settlement documents from one particular trustee on the board of trustees who leaks the settlement documents to them. And Ziegler flies to Philadelphia, and the two of them spend basically 48 hours locked in a hotel room going through each of these settlement documents from the victims. So we learn right away, as they get into these, that Penn State wrote settlement checks to 36 individuals. Remember, at trial, there were only 8 total accusers. There were 10 cases, but victim 2 did not have a name. Alan Myers at trial, remember, it was his name is known only to God. And then victim 8 was the janitors. And so there were actually only 8, even though there were 10 cases. Well, you had 28 additional accusers come forward who were not part of the trial, but were compensated by Penn State. That total compensation paid out to the 36 was more than $130 million. So that's about $3.5 million per accuser. Proving, as Ziegler says, that, you know, victimhood is good business. So Zig flies into Philly, and he and Cipriano lock themselves up in this hotel. And Zig comments that his expectations had been to find stuff, you know, at what he called an 8 or a 9 level of, you know, a violation of bullshit, right? And that the actual score on his bullshit meter was an 11. Once he got his look at these documents. So the settlement documents made it clear to John that the unique nature of the case, the big dollars available from Penn State, the preservation of anonymity promised to the accusers, the tailwind blown at the accusers' backs by the media, it all enabled a feeding frenzy for those who understood just how easy the money was to get. In other words, the existing rules left a major hole that could be exploited, could be taken advantage of by someone who knew how to take advantage of it. And we learned that the accusers from the trial had landed some very large paydays as we got into those documents. So just to give you the scoreboard here. So Aaron Fisher, victim one, got $7.5 million. Alan Myers, even though his name wasn't given a trial, remember, he came out after the trial as an accuser. He got paid $6.9 million. Jason Simcisco, victim number three, got $7.25 million. Brett Hoetz, victim four, who became the star witness, who was the one that the lawyer and the investigator thought they turned the tape off and it was still running when they discussed how to get him to say that he was abused. He got 7.25. Michael Kajak, who was the guy who said originally that he saw Jerry Sandusky with an erection, and Sandusky asked him to touch his erection, but he didn't know what it was because he was only 10 years old. But then he changed the date by 4 years, which made him 14, which didn't make the story about not knowing what an erection was make a whole lot of sense. Well, Kajak changes his story many times, but he, in the end, comes to say that he was abused in three different circumstances, all coming after the McQueary incident. He got $8.1 million. Zach Constance, victim six, who was the boy who was lifted up to the shower to rinse his hair in the episode from 1998 that was to be expunged, got the least amount of money, got $1.5 million, basically because he told the truth. I mean, he could have easily come up with his own story and gotten a lot more money. Dustin Struble, victim seven, got $3.25 million. Victim eight, the janitors, there was no settlement because there was no victim. Sebastian Payton, victim number nine, received the biggest payday of all at $20 million. And Ziegler gets into that a little bit. And the lawyer for Payton was, you know, you had a couple of lawyers handling most of these cases. Payton had his own lawyer, didn't work with any other victim. That lawyer figured out pretty early on that that Penn State was protecting the Board of Trustees and angled everything that he did at the Board of Trustees and basically threatened them with the way that they put their case together. And in the end, his client got $20 million. The number 10 was Ryan Rittmeyer, who never even met Sandusky, but he got $5.5 million. So you total those trial accusers plus victim two added into it, and they got $67.5 million from Penn State for their claims. It's a lot of cash.
That's a lot. You got the Catholic Church scams. I think the ones that were local, I think they were only getting like $100,000 each. Put that in context, right?
Yeah, it's a staggering amount of money, and then to think that actually in total they pay out double that. But the Penn State Board of Trustees president, by the time they were writing the settlements, was a guy who runs a very successful hedge fund private equity firm out of Philadelphia by the name of Ira Lubert. And Lubert made all of these decisions. So Lubert was the guy that the lawyers interfaced with to present their cases and ultimately settle with. So the two lawyers that were the most prominent lawyers in this case were a guy we've discussed a number of times, Andrew Shubin, who was the State College-based personal injury attorney who had gotten involved with a number of the accusers from victim two to victim three, seven, and 10. So he had four of those first 10 accusers. And then Ben Andreozzi was the guy who represented Brett Hoetz. He was the one who was on that tape with the cop, victim number four. He also represented eight other accusers, many of the ones who come forward after trial. And he ultimately made more money than any other lawyer associated with the case. So over half of these accusers, so 36 get paid, 19 of them were handled by either Shubin or Andreozzi. So, you know, does involving Shubin accusers show just how easy this whole thing became? Boom. I'm sorry. Boom.
I think once he did the leg work on whoever came first, it was easy. He had a flat, cut and paste, right? It just needed a different name. And it sounds like what's his name is just doing, like I said, wanting to write checks to make it go away.
Exactly. So the first thing that really shocked Ziggler was just the shameless approach to this process by Shubin. So Shubin uses the same exact storyline 8 separate times. He cuts and pastes into 8 of these submissions for settlement the same exact language. And I mean, it's not like boilerplate upfront explanation language. It's specifics about how the accuser was groomed and where things occurred and things like that. And so he had 9 total that he represented. So I think he started off approaching this the hard way with doing a separate story for everyone and then said, what the hell? Why am I bothering? These guys are just writing checks. So let me just do a little cut and paste job. And so he did that. And you can find that same exact language in 8 of the settlement documents.
Hey, y'all. One thing I've learned in 16 years of being with my wife is that PMS and menopause are a very real deal. Thank goodness for Hormone Harmony. Hey, do you experience cravings or bloating? Do you feel a little bit down or off? Do you struggle to find comfort in your body? Do you experience bad sleep quality? Well, now it's easier to manage PMS and menopause with Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony supports hormonal balance and regulation. It relieves symptoms of menopause, supports cortisol, estrogen, and progesterone levels, promotes healthy weight loss, and curbs carb cravings. It improves sleep quality, reduces occasional bloating and gas, and it relieves hot flashes, and it relieves mood swings. Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through premenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds, and Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold, like hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, and occasional bloating and gas, or no desire to be intimate with someone, if you know what I mean. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. It has zero sugar, is gluten-free, dairy-free, non-GMO, and third-party tested. And the biggest benefit, my wife says, is feeling like herself again. And that's what women mention over and over in their reviews. And there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RLRC at checkout. That's HAPPYMAMMOTH.com and use the code RLRC for 15% off today. Hey, y'all, let me tell you about Mochi. Mochi is a telehealth platform that connects patients seeking medication-based weight loss treatment with board-certified doctors and dietitians to help them determine the best treatment options to accomplish that goal. Mochi's program is completely virtual, meaning you can access their services anywhere in the United States and you will be meeting with their team online. You deserve doctors that listen. Mochi is dedicated to providing holistic, patient-centered care that prioritizes overall well-being with the goal of transforming how weight management is approached. Mochi Health takes a holistic approach to weight loss that includes visit with board-certified doctors, nutrition consultations, and medications delivered to your door. Science-backed medications, including GLP-1s like Ozempic and generic compound versions, affordable and accessible, regardless of insurance coverage. With Mochi, their dietitians work hand-in-hand with your medication to create personalized nutrition plans that fit your lifestyle. Reach your weight loss goals with science-backed, FDA-approved GLP-1 medications and support from real doctors and guidance from registered dietitians and help with making easy and sustainable changes to achieve results. Y'all have seen this. My wife has done it. My brother-in-law has done it. One of my best friends is doing it, and it really is an amazing process that works. So get started at joinmochi.com and use code RLRC to receive $40 off. That's join, joinmochi.com and use code RLRC to receive $40 off and let Mochi help change your life.
So one of the most shocking of the trial accuser's documentation is victim number 3, Jason Simcisco, along with victim number 5, Michael Kajak. And that's because their settlement documents are completely different. I mean, they don't resemble in any way, shape, or form what their testimony was at trial. Their stories are essentially brand new. Victim 3's story became much more like victim number 1's, victim number 4's, or victim number 9's story, where now what had been a fairly benign original testimony about one encounter becomes now 100. And it's all the things. It's not just touching, it's oral sex, it's anal sex, it's all of that that kind of abuse. And you know, you can clearly see that that you've got Shubin understanding what Penn State is paying the big bucks for and making sure that his stories are going to fall in line with that. Michael Kajak, victim number 5, as I said, you know, his original story was that he was abused one time in a Penn State shower and he didn't know what an erection was because he was only 10. Well, he later changed the year, which would make him 14, but no one was concerned about the fact that he was 14, not 10, and didn't understand what an erection was. And so Kajak claimed in 2001, a number of episodes in Sandusky's car, in Penn State showers. Originally, it was Jerry showing his penis, and now it's anal rape. Years later, Kajak was forced to testify at Graham Spanier's trial, and he goes back to his original story. So he testifies with that story at Sandusky's trial. Then he and his lawyer submit settlement documents to Ira Lubert claiming this massive abuse at the hands of Sandusky. Then a couple of years later, he testifies at Spanier's trial, and he's back to the story that he told at Sandusky's trial. So which is it, the story at the Sandusky trial or the settlements, or just, you know, whatever story you're going to make up given what your audience is? So Kajak, as I said, had a different lawyer. He had this guy, Tom Klein, and his lawyer was actually very good friends with Ira Lubert. So you've got a lawyer representing a quote unquote victim dealing with someone from the Board of Trustees on a settlement that's actually a personal friend. Some might call that a conflict.
Right.
Shubin, being a small town personal injury attorney out of State College, didn't really have the clout to deal with Lubert. And so he cut a deal with Ross Feller Casey, a major law firm in the state. And that Casey is the brother of Senator Casey from Pennsylvania. So pretty powerful people in the middle of this thing. And so all of Shubin's settlements on behalf of his clients were settled by the Ross Feller Casey firm that had, again, longstanding relationships with Lubert. So you had handoffs going on from these small town attorneys to the bigwigs who would handle the negotiations with Lubert. Lubert acknowledged, as I said last time that we got together, to our fake accuser who went undercover, that many of these were not real, but stood behind that some of them were. And you'll hear that on next week's episode when we go through it. But what about, so that's the, those are the folks from the trial and that we knew about from the early episodes. But what about all these other accusers, these 28 accusers that come forward after the trial? As Zig goes through all of these settlement documents with Cipriano, they come to see the majority of the cases, especially the ones that got paid significant money, and part them into two buckets. There's a group they call the Lock Haven Five, which starts with Aaron Fisher, who was from the town of Lock Haven. But there are four additional accusers who come forward who get sizable settlements from Lock Haven. And then there's another group that we'll call the 1970s group that we will focus on in our next episode. But today we're going to talk about the Lock Haven Five. And so all of these accusers went to that same high school in Lock Haven, Central Mountain High School. It's the high school that had the football coach, Steve Trochetta, who Sandusky was volunteering for. Zig went and visited with Trochetta in 2013, who didn't outright say it, but winked and nodded and let Ziegler know that he knew that Fisher at the time was full of shit. He also said that upon his retirement, he was going to write a book. Ziegler has been on him about that, and the guy's changed his phone number, and so he's still hiding and doesn't want to rock the boat and tell his full story. But anyway, the Lock Haven Five are Aaron Fisher, a guy by the name of Frankie Probst, another guy named Josh Culver, a guy named Glenn Neff, and a guy named Skylar Coover. And so this episode, the meat of the episode, is really going through the stories of these other four that came after Fisher. So Probst, Frankie Probst, was known as Frank the Tank. This guy was a very large man. He ended up playing college football at the tight end position, played at a number of different schools. But, you know, this guy's 250, 260, and he was that size in high school. And he was a very large Sandusky supporter in the beginning of all the accusations against Sandusky. In fact, he was interviewed by NBC by Natalie Morales back in the day. And we played in this episode pieces of that interview where Probst goes on to talk about Sandusky as a fatherly figure, that he stayed at Sandusky's home many times, that he was never touched by Sandusky awkwardly. He does mention the thing everybody mentions, the hand on the knee, the arm around the shoulder, that kind of thing. He basically says as he grew older, that he sort of, you know, grew out of the relationship with Sandusky, not totally cutting off contact, but not having as much as they had in his earlier teens. During that interview, Natalie Morales asks Probst 14 times if Sandusky abused him, and he says no each and every time. That was in November of 2012 that he was interviewed by NBC. Just before his 30th birthday, which is when the statute of limitations would have run out to file a claim against Sandusky, Probst filed a claim. So he waited until 2016, just before his 30th birthday, to make a claim. And in that claim, he said that abuse went on all through high school. Now, this guy is a 250, 260 pound college football player. Sandusky at that point is, you know, in his mid to late 60s. You know, this guy's a college tight end. He has Andrew Shubin as a lawyer. He signs up with Shubin. So he has that Shubin-Rossfeller-Casey connection. And and Frank the Tank makes a claim, and we'll get into his totals later. Then there's this guy, Josh Culver, who makes a claim right after Sandusky is convicted. He actually makes the claim on June 28th of 2012. Ziegler publishes Culver's name on his website at the time, and Culver's baby mama reaches out to Zig to tell him that Culver's claim, that she wants to talk to him. He gets on the phone with her, and she tells him that Culver's claim was complete BS. Her name is Tennille Jones, and we hear a number of clips from her in the episode, but she knew some things that weren't public, so she could only know them from Culver. His settlement was $5 million, which she knew that had never been reported publicly. She told the story of Culver telling her that he stayed up three straight nights so that he would be completely exhausted, so that he could cry when he delivered his rehearsed story to the police. His claim was that he was abused in 2001 and 2002 by Sandusky three times, once in a Penn State dorm, once in a locker room, where he made attempts that, you know, to me seem rather obvious, to where he's trying to paint himself as the alleged janitor's victim with the timing of the story and where it supposedly occurs. And he claims abuse in Sandusky's home. He claimed he went on bowl game trips with Sandusky. Culver was represented by a lawyer named Clifford Readers. So another separate guy. And Zig does an interview with Readers. And the interview with Readers, which is included in this episode as well, is really pretty funny. This guy has no information. He can't answer any of Ziegler's questions, won't answer any of Ziegler's questions, but he produced a documentary film. He makes a documentary film, and that's what he submits to Ira Lubert in order to get the settlement on behalf of Culver.
Yeah, he doesn't want that coming out. Yeah.
The next guy is a guy by the name of Glenn Neff, and he made his claim in September of 2016. So he also waited it out 4 years. Why would anyone wait 4 years to make a claim like that? Don't know. But similarly, Ziegler publishes his name, and he hears from a guy by the name of Chad Buskirk, who was a friend of Neff's. Buskirk worked with Neff and gave him a place to stay. So he was, quote unquote, friend of the family. He had worked for Neff's dad for a period of time. And so he was more doing a service for Neff's dad than he was for Neff. But he takes him in for a little bit of time, and he says that Neff was just completely full of shit. Buskirk tells Ziegler that at one point Neff took him to meet Jerry Sandusky, that he didn't believe it when Neff told him he knew Sandusky because of all the bullshit stories that Neff had told him in the past. But Neff one day says, let's go see my friend Jerry Sandusky. Buskirk gets in the car with him. They drive over to Sandusky's house. Dottie answers the door. She hugs Neff, obviously knows who he is. She yells upstairs to Jerry. Jerry comes down, was in the middle of shaving, so he's still got like shaving cream on his face and stuff. And Jerry gives Neff a hug, and the three of them sit down and talk for about 30 minutes. Years later, Buskirk is shocked when Sandusky is arrested and the accusations are made. And he asks Neff about those reports about Sandusky, and Neff tells him, all of these people are lying. There's no way Sandusky could have done any of this. Then a few years later, Neff reaches out to Buskirk. He's now claiming that he is a victim. He asks Buskirk to tell his attorney. So he asks Buskirk to lie to his attorney, to Neff's attorney, and say that he witnessed Jerry Sandusky kissing Neff the day they went to Sandusky's house a few years earlier. Buskirk tells Neff, fuck no, I'm not going to lie for you. Neff tries to bribe Buskirk with an offer of a new pickup truck if he will lie for him. Buskirk saw Zig's article about Neff getting $7 million and decided to reach out to Zig with his story after seeing that. Aaron Fisher and Neff were good friends. Frankie Probst waited 5 years to make his claim, and his abuse claim went all the way through his senior year, even though the guy was a 260-pound 18-year-old at that point. Buzz Kirk knew Probst a little bit, and he says he was also full of shit. Then you've got this guy, Skylar Coover, who makes his claim right after Josh Culver. Culver had come out in late June of 2012. Zig believes that the Lock Haven Five is at least partly his creation, meaning that Zig is posting all of this information about his point of view of the case and that these accusers are fake. And he's talking about why Penn State is such easy prey here. And he's convinced that some of what he's doing is giving ideas to people about how to go get some of that easy money from Penn State. And so, you know, he exposed just how easy it was to defraud Penn State, and seemingly everyone in Lock Haven was reading his posts and visiting his website because it was getting a significant amount of traffic, and he was hearing from a lot of people in that area. And so he's convinced that Neff, Coover, Culver, and Probst all saw how easy it was for Aaron Fisher to lie and get the money that he got. And so they just jumped on board the gravy train. These five guys all know each other. They all went to the same high school. Tennille, who was the baby mama of Josh Culver, said that he sold drugs to at least, she knew one of the guys, but thought that perhaps he was dealing to all of them. They all knew Fisher, and they all knew what Fisher's reputation was. Zig interviews another woman by the name of Jenna Spolstuff, who comes forward after hearing the Buzz Kirk interview. And she ultimately was one of Zig's biggest disappointments because she was Neff's baby mama, and she comes forward telling Zig her story, but then gets scared because, you know, all of these guys, when you go and look at them, they all have records, and they're not just driving violations. These people have, you know, all records of significant, sometimes violent crimes. And so even after the fact, someone like Jenna, who knows that that Neff is full of shit, wants to come forward, yet stopped by a parent or a sibling that says, look, it's just too dangerous for you to go forward. And in this case, it's her father who says, you know, you can't do that interview. You can't expose yourself. You've got little kids, et cetera. And so Zig did record in a very sloppy way through the phone his first conversation with Jenna. So we get a little bit of what transpired between him and Jenna, but we don't get the full interview that he was hoping to get. But if you look at the Lock Haven Five, Aaron Fisher, $7.5 million. Frankie Probst, Frank the Tank, the 260-pound tight end, gets $9 million. Didn't file a complaint until 2016. Neff gets $7 million. Josh Culver gets $5 million. And then Skylar Coover, who's the last one of these stories we're going to get into, gets $7 million. So the town of Lock Haven collectively gets $35.5 million through these five claims. The Skylar Coover story is the one that Ziegler says, you know, broke him. It was the one that just got him to turn his back on the case for a while. He dropped his pencil and said, that's it, I can't take this anymore. And took like 6 months off before diving back into it. But he'd never had a person with all of these people that are coming forward and all the articles on his blog and the mini documentary that he did. He'd never had anyone come forward in defense of one of these accusers until this woman by the name of Shannon Bruno came forward in defense of Skylar Coover. She was Skylar Coover's mother. But Coover had shut her out. He was no longer speaking to her. He had cut her out of his life. So Zig speaks to Shannon Bruno for 2 hours. She tells him how she loves Sandusky, how close Coover was to Sandusky. Coover tells his pastor in the army that he was abused by Sandusky. Like I said, he cut his mother out of his life. She recalls an argument between Sandusky and Coover. And at that point, it was right after the argument that Coover cuts Sandusky out of his life and subsequently cuts his mother out of his life. Then he renews his relationship with his mother. Two other people come forward, Mike Zidek Jr. and Mike Zidek Sr. They're stepbrother and stepfather, former stepbrother and stepfather of Coover's. And they say that Coover and Culver were very good. Josh Culver and Skylar Coover were very good friends. They used the same attorney again as Fisher. Zidek's father gets involved in all of this. Zidek said Coover owned a sanitation company and stopped picking up Zidek's garbage because Zidek and his buddy referred to Coover's, quote, molester money. So it got to the point where friends were literally making fun of these guys because they knew they had defrauded Penn State out of millions and their stories were bullshit. And so they're referring to it as molester money and making fun of these guys. Zidek knew this was all bullshit. He said that both Skylar and Culver told him that they lied about Sandusky and they offered him a bribe to keep his mouth shut. He had, at the point that the interview took place, Coover had two warrants out for his arrest. Neff had been arrested recently for a bad check. And that's an important point that people might not necessarily think of here is you might say, well, why after a number of years would these guys still all be on good behavior and how come nobody's broken and come clean that they lied? Well, all of these settlements were done as, you know, structured settlements, payments made over time. So they weren't delivered a lump sum of $7 million. It was paid out over a period of years. And that was specifically to keep all of these guys in line and keep their mouths shut. Neff actually went to court to try and get all of his money released. He claimed some kind of personal circumstance that demanded he get his money immediately. The judge in the case couldn't understand why Penn State was so opposed to paying in a lump sum, but ultimately held up that the structured settlement would remain and he didn't get his money up front.
Hey, y'all, changing my wardrobe from summer to fall? Hey, it's never easy. Luckily, Quince offers timeless and high-quality items I adore, ensuring my wardrobe stays fresh and I don't blow my budget. And there's nothing easier than going to Quince and choosing these high-quality items, like cashmere sweaters from $50, pants for every occasion, washable silk tops, and so much more. The best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes, and I love that. Look, I got the stainless steel Link Apple Watch band for $59.90, and it's heavy duty, it's awesome, and it's like $100 less than I could find anywhere else. And I also got 100% organic cotton fisherman quarter zip up sweater. The color is alabaster. Man, I can't wait to wear that dude out this fall. And Cindy got the Mongolian cashmere boat neck sweater and heather gray. And I'm telling you, these are classic pieces at a fraction of the price. Make switching seasons a breeze with Quince's high quality closet essentials. Go to quince.com/RLRC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/RLRC to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/RLRC. You'll thank me later. Hey, y'all. You want to set your child up for success? Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with the subject? Is your child ahead, not getting challenged enough in class? Well, IXL Learning is an online learning program that enriches your homeschool curriculum. It offers practice in math, English, language arts, science, and social studies while adapting to each child, meeting them where they are. Plus, IXL encourages students to become curious and empowers them to choose how to learn. Look, we homeschool our son. No doubt about it. He's more of a visual learner, and we use IXL, and Cindy teaches him, and there are so many different benefits to the program. It adapts to exactly what he needs in different areas. So IXL is the perfect supplement to your homeschool curriculum. IXL offers interactive practice problems, educational games, lessons, and video tutorials for every topic you're teaching at home. It's easy to use, time-saving. Everything on IXL is organized by grade, subject, topic, and subtopic, making it simple to find activities for the exact skills you're covering. IXL offers instant feedback and explanations of new topics as kids use the program. Kids can explore any topic in any grade level. They aren't forced into a single learning path like they are on other programs. If you're homeschooling your child because they were falling behind or because they were too far ahead like our son, IXL is a great program to help them get the exact support they need. Kids love IXL's positive feedback awards and educational games. IXL is trusted by 15 million students worldwide and has proven to improve performance in over 75 scientific research studies. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Real Life Real Crime listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. And don't forget, Real Life Real Crime listeners get 20% off. Y'all, we really do use this product, and it's been a godsend.
The quote-unquote accuser that, and I would say this is true to this day, that Ziegler and I think Dottie Sandusky and Jerry Sandusky think is the one who could eventually crack and come clean. And you could easily see him doing it for the wrong reasons too, because you could see him doing it for money, because Matt Sandusky got less money than anyone we have talked about. I think there are a few fringe accusers that might've got a little bit less than him, but he only got $325,000 for coming out and as an adopted child of Jerry and Dottie, claiming that he was abused, getting his story leaked to NBC, doing it during the middle of the trial, et cetera. And for sure, he's out of money. His foundation is closed. He was last seen working in a pizza parlor somewhere in the area. And so I could see somebody, you know, coming to him, dangling some money. But then again, if it's a story he does for money, you know, who's necessarily going to buy that now he's telling the truth because he's getting paid money again to talk. So who knows? But there's one other settlement contract that Zig mentions, which is from a guy named Travis Weaver. And he did an interview claiming he was a victim. Penn State actually pushed back a little bit against his claim. He then changed his date to a time within the window that Penn State was paying. He originally claimed he was abused between 1991 and 1996, and then he changed the date. In all of these agreements, there's an NDA, and there's also a stipulation that the payment does not mean that the story is true, that Penn State is not vouching that this story is true. They're they're making a payment anyway, and they're asking the accuser to sign a non-disclosure as part of that settlement. This guy Weaver came forward in 2011, yet he was not part of the trial. Why would he not have been part of the trial if he came forward in 2011 with his abuse claim? And that's got to be because prosecutors didn't see him as a credible witness. So there's also a story of a guy named Rodney Rausch, who hired Shubin and Rossfeller Casey. He filed in January of 2013. He alleged that in 1998, Sandusky touched his leg and then masturbated at a Penn State golf course. So some of these guys just weren't reading the notes to understand what the pattern was supposed to be. And they come in with these accusations that don't fit the supposed MO. And so Rouse says he reported that claim to the athletic director. This is the guy in the job before Tim Curley at Penn State. Once he received his money, he refused to testify that he reported anything to the athletic director. He ends up getting $200,000 from Penn State just to go away. So, as I said, we've often talked about the raw numbers of this case, the big raw number of 36 accusers compensated by Penn State. And, you know, it's so hard for anyone to see past a number like that. It's especially hard when the media has done nothing but, you know, blow more and more wind into the story over time. But, you know, as we've said from the get-go, when you look at the story and you evaluate each of these accusers and each story on its own merits, you know, and you look at how this unfolded, the perverse set of incentives involved. I mean, each of these stories crumbles, and there's not a one save possibly Zach Constance's story, the 1998 accuser, that holds up over time. I mean, he's the only one you can look at and say his story never changed, didn't change at trial, didn't change after trial. This guy went back to having a relationship with Sandusky immediately after the supposed incident. That relationship continued into his adulthood. That's the only one. I mean, every other one of these guys changed their story multiple times in multiple cases of victim three and victim five. We even see them changing their case from the original trial to the settlements and then to other trials for the administrators that they had to testify in, where they go back to stories they had told before they went after the settlements. And so, I don't know, dude.
The one common theme, naturally, and I'm sure it came from the lawyers, because these guys probably weren't smart enough. I'm not saying that they're all lying, but it always happened on Penn State or a Penn State sponsored trip. Penn State had to be involved to get the big checks. So like we said, Sandusky didn't have the money. I mean, who knows how many more they brought forward. Well, I don't even think a lawyer would bring one forward that didn't say, you know, say it happened at Penn State at some point in time. And I still don't believe Sandusky was stupid enough to do it at Penn State or, you know, in a swimming pool or a trip and shit like that. So the Penn State paid, and the money is what it is. It's crazy.
Well, and you'll see with this fake accuser that comes forward, he goes to Shubin He goes to Andrew Shubin and he tells him a story about Sandusky raping him in the woods behind Paterno's home. It's just bizarre. He just yanks his story out of his ass that Sandusky's raped him outside of Paterno's yard. And when he comes back for his second visit to Shubin has completely rewritten his story. The abuse has now taken place on Penn State campus, not in the woods behind Paterno's house. And so this guy is taking every one of these bullshit artists who walks into his office. He's reshaping their stories to conform to what Penn State is willing to pay for, and then hands those over to this powerful Philadelphia law firm, who then goes and visits with Lubert and gets the settlement they can get. And it's a factory I mean, they're just churning these things out for years. It's crazy.
It's crazy. The I don't get it. The, you know, the lawyers made at least 33 1/3 off that, if not 40% off every one of them. And the guy writing it, you know, the NDAs and paying it out over time and all that shit is what it is. But still, like Joe Paterno's, I mean, naturally, if Sandusky's innocent, he's a loser in this case. But Joe Paterno's a real fucking loser. Because, yeah, I don't believe that he knew anything, period. And it is what it is.
Well, and next week's gonna break your heart on that, because it broke mine. The next batch, the final batch of settlements of accusers that we're going to go through next week are people who came forward claiming they were abused by Sandusky in the 1970s, yeah, and that Paterno was aware of the abuse. And they come forward at the exact time that momentum has built for a total restoration of Paterno's reputation, you know, gonna give naming rights to the field, going to put the statue back up. The victories have been reinstated by the NCAA. The board of directors has said that they don't believe anything in the free report. They've denounced the results of the free report. And the stage is completely set for the resurrection of Paterno's reputation, and then these 1970s stories come, and the press takes the bait on the 1970s story, and our favorite reporter Sarah Ganim gets right in the middle of it again with these stories, and we'll go through those next week. And
I wonder how many more came forward that Zig didn't know about. Maybe they. You know what I mean?
That cases that were so ridiculous, like, they were turned away?
Well, no, later that are prescribed, because that's what happened here. I'm sitting here thinking about it, the money on the Catholic Church thing. The reason they paid them such a low amount is because it was after prescription. Right? It's 30, 40 years later when all the complainants were coming out, and they didn't have to pay them anything. Right? But they... The lawyers filed the suits anyway, and basically they I'm certainly not saying that they were all lying or whatever, but sure some of them were, but they paid them just to, you know, their names were John Doe's and stuff like that, but they paid them just to go away. Yeah, so they didn't have to pay them anything.
I don't know. I know Zig has tried to get the list of the stories of the ones that they turned down, because if they're paying on some of the ridiculous stories they paid on, what must the stories have been that they decided not to pay on? And I think
I tell you what, it'd be the ones that came in and said it didn't happen on Penn State property.
Yeah. Yeah. Came in with the wrong lawyer who didn't know how the thing had to be packaged and weren't consistent with the pattern. You're right. But I'm told that that these 70s stories don't exactly fit the pattern either, and you'll see that next week when we get into it. So be safe out there, everybody. Thanks for listening. All that good podcaster stuff.
Podcaster shit.
Got some cool weather this week. Some hunting weather, Woody.
Yeah, man. I think Wednesday the high is going to be in the 70s, but it was 60 out this morning, and when I was outside before we started recording, and it's still going to be like 90 degrees this afternoon, but that's, you know, it's almost there, almost time, and the won't be long now. Still good weather.
Where's the good money? Where's the good money this weekend?
The man, I don't know. It's kind of tough this weekend. I'm scared of LSU. It's the 100-year anniversary of Tiger Stadium. It's always the big game. When I was a kid, the big game, the big rivalry game wasn't Alabama and all that. It was Ole Miss. I can remember as a little boy, the fans chanting, go to hell, Ole Miss, go to hell. But Ole Miss, when they're number six, got beat, and they got back last week and roll on it. But LSU, man, either they're going to win out the rest of the season or they're going to not win another game.
How about my Commodores? How about my Commodores?
Yeah, I saw that. But I was watching them tear down the goalposts and stuff the other night. They said they carried it all the way to the river and threw it in the river, the goalposts.
All the way downtown to the Cumberland River. Crazy.
They're plus 14 against South Carolina, something like that. I'm going to bet down.
Look, they lost in overtime to Missouri when Missouri was ranked sixth.
Right.
And they should have won. They had a kick to win it that he missed. They went overtime with somebody else that was ranked. I can't remember. But those are their only two losses. I have no idea how they became good. I guess it's anybody can get lucky in the transfer portal. But then they're going to – all those guys are going for greener pastures next year, so they're going to lose all these good guys they got for 1 year. So, but, hey, make hay with it while you can.
Hey, I got to ask – I got to ask you something about the Giants. I was flipping through the NFL channel or whatever it is, and they said that the Seattle ran back a 99-yard – was it a fumble?
Yes.
Like the guy just set the ball down or something? And
he tried to leap over the goal line. A helmet hit the ball. I mean, we spotted them that in the first minute of the game and then came back and won that game and won that game without – Malik and without one of the major defensive players, so Thibodeau.
That's so the question is Neighbors playing this weekend? Malik,
I believe he is. I believe he is. I think he cleared. Yeah. It was concussion. I think he cleared. So we shall see. But Lions Dallas. That's the game. Come on, your team against the Lions.
Yeah. But you know what? I like the Lions. Lions are probably my second favorite team. Amon St. Brown, I watched him a couple of years ago when he was a rookie, and they did an interview with him. He's catching 1,000 balls a day after practice from the machine. Okay, this dude's going to be a stud. And his brother plays, and his dad was, a coach and all that.
Wasn't his dad arm wrestler or something? What was his dad? His dad was a bodybuilder.
His dad was his bodybuilder. And he used to make him work out every day and like every day, like even on Christmas and shit, they made him work out. But Dallas is horrible. They have no running game. I've never seen Dallas with the shittiest running game as they have now. I mean, they got Zeke Elliott's way beyond his prime, and then Rico, whatever his name, and Dowdle was averaging like 2 yards a carry before last week.
No, they might finish last in the division. They might.
Yep, somebody's finally going to get fired.
we'll see. Anyway, good luck. Bet with your brain.
You too, man.
And I'll talk to you.
Yeah, have a
good Thanks, folks.
Have a good one, bro.
Aglets.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.